This is tape recording number 5110C26B, Foundation Auditors Course Part 1, FAC number 7. A tape recorded lecture given by L. Ron Hubbard on the 26th of October, 1951. The title of this lecture is The Evolution of Man According to the Facsimile. It is 55 minutes and 54 seconds long. Copyright C, 1951-1974 by L. Ron Hubbard. All world performance rights reserved. This recording has been re-recorded. This recording has been re-recorded by the Flag Audio Unit of the Flagship Apollo of the Sea Organization. And now, here is L. Ron Hubbard.
Today I want to talk to you about several small items, but the first part of this should be entitled The Evolution of Man. I want to give you a little brief resume on evolution as she plots by fact similes. I don't care what it plots by on the beaches or anything else. Actually, an enormous amount of objective evidence exists in this particular line. The theory of evolution was a happy thought on the part of the fellow who wrote the fourth Vedic hymn. And when that material got into Europe in the 18th century, the boys, what is that hum? Is that window open? The fourth Vedic hymn actually contains the theory of evolution. That was written, I think, well, it was certainly word of mouth before they could write. As I say, it wandered in during the 18th century, and in the very early part of the 19th century, it had been bruited about somewhat. And then somebody looked up one day and found out that horses in the highlands of Persia grew long hair, but when brought into the plains, grew short hair. When went back into the mountains, they grew long hair, and so on. So they said, gee, let's make a science out of it. A lot of people monkeyed around with it. There's a fellow by the name of Lysenko messed it up somehow. And there's a lot of people been banging their brains out on this for a long time. I speak rather disrespectfully of them because they did a lousy job. A very good piece of work was done by a fellow by the name of Darwin. Darwin had the odd feeling. He suddenly said, you know, there's a blinding flash that occurred to him. He said, you know, I think that one ought to take a look at the real world and see what cook. And this staggering flash sent him off on a trip around the world, from which he returned to be completely machine-gunned, guillotined, executed, riddled. As a matter of fact, he was assaulted from all sides, driven back from every parapet, discredited, and finally, we have the theory of evolution by Charles Darwin. Well, actually, there is no theory of evolution. I've never seen the law stated as such, but I've heard the theory of evolution mentioned many times, and yet I've seen no codification of it. I've seen some attempts to codify it, but the theory of evolution as stated has holes in it. And when I say is stated, it's written down here and there. It's got a lot of holes in it. It is not, as it existed a few years ago, a workable plot. But it has, I mean, a wholly workable plot. But some of it is workable. And as a consequence, they've kept it around sort of for old sakes. And biology has a lot of fun with it. But the theory of evolution, as practiced in biology, the theory of evolution is practiced in cytology. The theory of evolution has practiced in the field of animal husbandry, again, in sociology, again, in psychology, are five different theories of evolution. They do not agree one with another. And so, I wouldn't blame anybody for being a little bit confused about it. You see, the missing link in it was the insistence on individuals that all of this information, which would go to make up the blueprint of a living organism, was somehow or other on file, but never under any circumstances must be available or something. Now, we've got here a complete piece of nonsense. The living organism grows, but it doesn't have anything on file. There is no blueprint. Well, the blueprint's carried in the genes. The blueprint's carried in the genes, yeah, that's simple. It's an impulse. Now, this is blank at the whole subject, an impulse. Memory is something else. Memory is what you forget you had for breakfast with. And here, obviously, the living organism has to have a construction blueprint. Obviously has to have one. Well, if we want to be completely in aim, we say, well, it has one, but it's not on file. I'd like to see you build a factory where everybody came around and said, well, you follow the blueprint. And you say, yeah, but where's the blueprint? Well, they're not on file. No, not available. Nobody can have them. Now, that would be really something. You wouldn't get much of a factory built. And yet, we see all around us in the world today, we see living organisms. At least some of them are partly alive. Saw a kitten the other day that was alive. And here you have, then, somebody shoving off an imponderable as logical. They were posing this phenomenon, that the living organism comes into being on a blueprint which is not available to the living organism. That would really be a phenomenon. They were saying a factory gets built, although nobody knew where anything was supposed to go or what shape it was supposed to be, and nobody ever had a blueprint of the factory. Have you ever seen a building built without blueprints? An interesting building, usually. Cellar door connects in the second story, and other interesting things occur. Now, whereas it may be perfectly true that psychiatrists are built without a blueprint, I do not think that living organisms are. I think that they have a blueprint. One fine day, I started to look for some material on the track and found myself treading water. You ever see these cartoons where the little guy runs off the end of the cliff and he goes way out into space and he's still running, and then all of a sudden he notices that he's way off the ground. And the second he notices this, he falls. Well, I went off the back of the time track with a pre-clear, just about in that fashion, what I consider the beginning of the time track, and I found myself doing the same thing, much to the astonishment of the pre-clear. He found himself being a place where there wasn't any place to be. Now, the data which was accumulated in the ensuing months became more and more interesting. I call to your attention the valence mechanism. You can see this operate in this lifetime in any prequel. You send him back down the track and he's out of valence. In order to get him into valence, you have to take him to an area where he was in apathy. And only by working an awful lot of effort can you get him to the no effort of being in valence again, and then up the tone scale to where he is. So he wants this work. Call to your attention this other phenomenon. An interesting one it is. Josie had a grandfather. Grandfather died when she was 7 years of age. That was the end of Grandpa. And you take Josie back on the time track, and you find Grandpa, do you? Not if it's really got a charge on it. You don't find Grandpa. You don't even find Grandpa way back earlier, before he died. You don't find Grandpa anyplace if this is really occluded. The twisteroo on the valence. This individual shuts out, and every individual has, in his lifetime, several people who are closed off in this fashion. Call to your attention, you've seen this mechanism. Now let me call to your attention another mechanism that an individual can have ARC with himself, but he doesn't have it. His command center is to him, he is to his command center, an organism, much on the order of associated organisms. except he's just more intimately associated with the bottle. So we lose Grandpa on the track, and we lose the pre-clear every time he kicks off. Here you have the individual defeated by death, and you get close-off. And it's simply a valence shift mechanism, just as it is in an ally. Nothing much to this, because if you start working it over, you find out that you go back and find a time when this individual was a great disappointment to himself. And if you turn that on and turn it up, you will find an enormous amount of material earlier than that appearing on the track. Also call it the detention of auditors of the exclusion of material before the first out-of-valence flick that the pre-clear does. You know, childhood, something like that. Your main service facsimiles are up there. Usually they happen between 3 and 10. You'll find the material before that first serious service facsimile very messed up, very cloudy, or shut off entirely. People cannot remember their childhoods. This is why people can't remember their childhoods. They flicked out of valence. They have gone through a sort of a symbolic death through failure. Now, you get that mechanism. That's a very, very basic mechanism. Now, you take a pre-clear way back down the track, and you'll run into all sorts of things. The odd part of it is that you run into deaths. I'm very sorry if this is a sore subject in any place, but you can't work anybody by effort processing without bumping, whether you want it or not, bumping into a death. Sooner or later, if you just keep working him by effort processing, he's going to be lying there dead in a mackerel in his coffin with everybody saying, "Poor Oswald." And your pre-clear says, "Oswald, Oswald, Oswald, Oswald." Seems familiar. But you bring the rest of the death up, and he's more willing to be Oswald. You see, Oswald failed. He died, and he shouldn't have. This is against the rules. This is a little joke life plays on you. They say you. It says, you've got to live, and then kills you. It's very simple. And you're alive as long as you stay in there fighting with full ARC. You're not when you're not. Well, anyhow, this phenomena is of beta facsimiles back down the track before the time track is supposed to start, is very easy to find. And one should find it much easier to accept the fact that the theta facsimiles are on file than that they're not on file. Man had done this valence shift to a point where, even in his existing cultures, he said, "Well, I was never connected to anything before. I just suddenly arose here and floated, and here I am. There's no blueprint. My talents, my skills, these sort of things, they're just sort of inherent because I'm bright. I was born, and I couldn't remember a thing, everybody told me, until I was 3. Of course, the funny part of it was I had learned the full English language before I was 3, but of course I can't remember that. That's why I don't speak English. So they keep posing these utterly mad ideas. It's introduction of an arbitrary and the introduction of another arbitrary because nobody ever looked for the theta facsimiles. Well, there was something wrong that they didn't look for them. I think they were just scared. I wouldn't say anything harsh of them. I just think they've been yellow. And you find this cowardice in individuals that you suddenly start to work with, and you say, "Now, let's go back and see if we can find anything before the track begins." And they let out a pale scream, and they can say, "Well, you nasty thing, you believe that there's such a thing as, that's terrible." And boy, will they get upset. It's a cowardice. The guy doesn't want to go back and get killed. Y'all. Now, the net result of all this is the most valuable datum on any such track of evolution would be death. You can't make the theory of evolution work unless the organism could find out how it failed. If it knows how it failed, then it can repair or fix up its future generations so that it won't fail. But if anybody tells me that an organism believes it is in the process of failing when it's procreating, no, no. And yet, according to your theory, that's where it takes off. It takes off along a genetic line. Birth, growth, procreation. So you'd have a silly-looking cycle that would go birth, growth, procreation. Birth, growth, procreation. Birth, growth, procreation. No failures. Well, so obviously we're all still algae. Well, whereas this may apply to certain fields of science, I hope it doesn't apply here. I don't believe all the living organisms are static. I don't believe they're still floating in a sea of ammonia. I believe they progressed. Well, why did they progress? Well, that's very easy to figure out. They reasoned it out. No, that's wrong. And they naturally selected themselves out, so they're no longer here. Of course, they never had a single theta facsimile to tell them that they had been naturally selected out so as to construct something new that wouldn't get selected out. It was all a gunshot proposition. It's unfortunate for the people who have followed this long line of evolution that none of them were mathematicians. It's unfortunate because they probably would have blown this problem sky wide 100 years ago if anybody had been able to figure it. They have posed an infinity of factors, an unattainable infinity of factors, when they say natural selection is all there is. You just can't figure it, that's all. If they're saying another one, they're saying that the original protoplasm contained in it, not just the potentialities, but the full design of every future organism. How incredible can we get? Now we have given to this minute bit of protoplasm enormous and miraculous power, which it obviously does not possess, and wiped aside any logical explanation. Now, here's the way natural selection works. The initial piece of protoplasm, you see, they even go to the point of saying the environment has no bearing and does not shape the organism. I guess maybe you don't realize that, but it's like you used to talk to people about psychoanalysis. Everybody's got everything buttoned up in the field of the mind. You say, well, not necessarily. Psychoanalysis certainly has it. And they'd say, well, why don't you? Well, it's obvious that it's been around for a long time. So obviously it has everything buttoned up. You say the formula of James Clerk Maxwell on the theory of electricity were in full bloom in 1894. The libido theory of Sigmund Freud was in full bloom in 1894. Out of the formulas of James Clerk Maxwell, we have the atom bomb. We've still got the libido theory. So it isn't a very live theory. So you say, all the way up the line, no. It's hard to believe, unless you're in the field, that this actually exists as a prime tenet, that the environment does not influence the organism. Whereas everywhere we look, we find organisms fitted to the environment, to survive in the environment. We find that the adaption has been quite good, one way or the other. We're just going on the adaption theory. And yet, they say it's all inherent in this bit of protoplasm at the beginning of track. And then somehow or other, every time it didn't, then somebody, every time it didn't click quite, why, that line died off and it left all the other lines carrying on. This is incredible. Because it poses an infinity of shapes and sizes, it imposes an infinity of happy circumstances and lucky accidents. Let's just leave it all to the roulette wheel down at Las Vegas and not think. It's very definitely a 1-1 or a 05 line of reasoning. I can show you a palm tree. It's a form of life. A palm tree can hardly support its fronds where there isn't any wind. If you want to look for a perfect airfoil, go look at a palm frond. It's a perfect airfoil. You mean to say that this piece of protoplasm at the beginning of the track could build a perfect airfoil for a beach and a climate of which it knew nothing? Now, this is real genius we're posing here, and I think the boys got somewhat clouded up on the thing. Of course, you can go back behind this and find out why did this impulse start in the first place, but you will find out that life forms are adapted. That palm frond is actually molded by wind. Generation after generation after generation, the wind itself molds a perfect airfoil. Now, it's interesting that there would be no impulse to mold a perfect airfoil or recreate the pattern of a perfect airfoil unless somewhere along the line the palm had a chance to find out that its airfoils were failing. It has that perfect airfoil in order to support its fronds. They're very heavy. The wind blows very hard. Your palm frond supports itself as an airfoil and can exist. It can live. It can stay on the tree. But you let the wind die out completely and stay died out, and its weight will break it off the tree. It's too heavy. Interesting, isn't it? There's millions of these things in life. The study of biology is just sown with these tremendously intricate and happy and beautiful combinations of organisms to defeat time. Well, you start looking along the track and you'll find theta facsimiles. You'll find the theta facsimiles, which are the blueprint. This is quite a remarkable discovery, actually. I do feel that somebody might have thought it up and looked before, but I guess the world's in a pretty sad state. It stands as a discovery, something that obviously should have been suspected was there all the time. Theta facsimiles of the blueprint. They're all on file. Furthermore, the failures are on file. Evidently, there are parallel lines there. One line, the blueprint line, parallels only the protoplasm line. Very interesting material. Now, as you go back along the line, you'll find out, as you process preclears, that there are very, very few preclears who don't suddenly turn up with early failure facsimiles. The odd part of it is that when a preclear picks up a service facsimile, he picks up a package. Now, it's all right for you just to go into one life, this life, and somehow or other get the incident, the service facsimile of this life, off the package and square it around in this life. It's all right for you to do that. But you'll find out that you'll occasionally get there much more swiftly by knocking out the earlier part of the bundle. Therefore, you should know something, and you should look, because you are indeed doing a lot of exploring. You're examining a few billion years worth of theta facsimiles that nobody's ever looked at before, except the cells as a blueprint. But as far as a mind unit is concerned, you are for the first time looking at these things. They're very interesting. There's data on that track, the like of which nobody ever suspected existed. The biologist could find out, looking on that track now, exactly why, what the roots were. 1,000 imponderable questions in biology suddenly resolved. And they, believe me, they resolved they don't leave much question in a fellow's mind. He looks at this tremendous piece of logic. He looks at this thing and he says, well, of course this step happened. Yeah, that's how it did it. So on. I say the biologist has been beating his brains out ever since Leeuwenhoek in an effort to find out how it happened. Well, the front window of the world's been opened up as far as you're concerned. You can sure take a look. Now, there are two or three points which have been recovered in this. You can examine the whole tract for your own edification. But there are two or three points which, unless you've been through them as an auditor, you might miss in a pretty way. And one is the fact that man is two, not one. You might miss this. The basic unit of the universe is two. And the basic unit of man is two, not one. Funny part of it is that a man is not an individual. He's two. The exact point has not been recovered. But the points before and after it have been recovered. Your evolution chain starts on something like a very elementary photon converter. Now, just what this is exactly is not hard to stretch your imagination over, because you can find them still alive on Earth. They are algae, plankton, monocells. But the photon converter that you'll find at the beginning of the track is much more elementary than an algae. An algae is a late and well-developed organism. It is a complete animal. It subdivides. It's called a monocell. That's why it needs no mating up in order to regenerate. Now, where this original photon converter is, that's not well established. Perceptions are very poor at that point on the track, from what I've observed so far. But impulses aren't. And we have here, going right along with it, ample proof of a theta facsimile characteristic. Theta facsimiles are not force, but they contain a pattern of force, because the initial photon converters, which are microscopic in shape, can yet exert on your pre-clear enough force to leave him gasping badly. It's an overall somatic. Overall. And here you have an individual who is 100 or so pounds and so on, and he's being influenced by a theta facsimile, which is a facsimile of something which is microscopic size. And you see him puff and pant and wheeze. You understand immediately that a theta facsimile contains a pattern of mist that can impose itself authoritatively upon mist in no uncertain terms. But it doesn't care how big or how small. It doesn't care how big the mist is or how small it is. The pattern will fit. Now, starts out in this wise, carries along for a number of generations, many generations, and gets up to the rather advanced state of plankton. Its worries shift at that point. Very early, the photon converter is only interested in one thing. The state of not beingness comes first. The state of not beingness. This is complete static. Now, the first photon that hits it catalyzes it into 2B, because it bats it back. The next point is that it has to stop a few photons. Change them. And start them out another way. And therefore, this is the cycle of its motion. Start, stop, and change. The whole track from there right on forward till now has no other motions than these elementary and basic motions. Change the direction of a vector, stop it, or start it. From there on forward. It is a static which is handling nothing but motion. That's all. Every piece of physical force which it has borrowed from the physical universe. And yet it is catalyzed by an impulse or a static. Very interesting. Something lies behind that original photon converter. There is something earlier than that. But we won't go into it at this time, because we immediately move into the second echelon of research when we do. You'll find out that it has various problems, life does, along this track, and its first problem has to do with a cosmic ray. The bug in the ointment is the cosmic ray. They have spoken wisely, learnedly, and without any data about cosmic rays for a long time. I don't have the figures in mind to rattle them off. Something like 12 pass through your body every second of these cosmic rays. Whatever they are, they're not rays, however, they're particles. Mistakes which we were making back in 1930. I couldn't see, by the way, back in 1930, how in the name of common sense you could ever have a ray. It would have to be a particle flow. And yet I flunked an examination in atomic molecular physics because I insisted it was particle flow. This did not become stylish for about 10 years. Anyway, the point is that every so often, maybe once an hour, a cosmic ray explodes inside you. Those figures are simply estimates. They're figured out by quantum mechanics, and you can get any kind of an answer you want by quantum mechanics. You could even get the who's going to be next president by quantum mechanics by just instituting a few bugger factors. Now, the point is that its first problem is a burst. The bursting of a cosmic ray, gorgeous phraseology, of a cosmic particle is not unlike the explosion of an atom bomb. Into an algae is doggone near the same order of magnitude. Now you see, it wouldn't happen very often with a tiny, tiny particle like a photon converter on forward. Wouldn't happen often. But when it does happen, it's of about the same order of magnitude as New York and Chicago being wiped out simultaneously by atom bombs. Now, I'm not drawing a long bow there. If you wanted to go out and plant a lot of plankton and examine them very carefully, you would only have to observe them for just a few days before you would find one that had been destroyed by such a burst. You know, these things explode on photographic plates, so on. They were thought to be what caused mutation. And now we know how they cause mutation. An interesting answer, isn't it? They cause mutation. But not by any mysterious hocus-pocus magical force. They simply cause mutation by raising up such a fuss that they wipe something out so thoroughly that it now has a new type of theta facsimile, and it's got to take off into a better organism which is big enough to support the explosion of atomic rays. And there's the first engram. It's the explosion of a cosmic particle. By the way, those explosions are quite amusing. You start figuring them out, and the magnitude of explosion, the amount of energy released, is just fantastic. every once in a while, you may feel a twitch in your being. It'll be one of them exploding. But the thing that it's recording on, the cell in which it's recording, believe me, it's gone to glory. And it has received the kind of an engram that indicates it starts out, your early engrams, as holders. It tries to damp them out, that ambitious early convert. Bang goes the ray, it says stop. Hasn't got any experience yet. Now, the photon converter has an emotion, the emotion of acceptance and discharge. These are very simple emotions. These are the emotions to start, stop, to change. Now, it receives, in other words. In order to be, it has to receive. So you have the emotion of acceptance comes in about that level. It accepts, accepts, discharges, accepts, accepts, accepts. It's interesting. It goes on like that. And then all of a sudden, boom! It's busy accepting something, and the something is a cosmic particle and explodes. Now, you can find this in your pre-class. With ease, from head to toe, but possibly not too sensitively in the leg, this theta facsimile superimposes over the existing being and will get into resimulation and is usually brought up by service facsimiles. And it lays down a basic personality problem for the individual. The combination of acceptance, discharge, and explosion can be varied considerably. There are many variables, and out of this you can get a basic pattern of behavior. You should try this on a few pre-clears, but you'll never realize it's better than if it's tried on you. But you shouldn't have any qualms about what you're tackling. You're tackling something that is a long engram to reduce, but it's simplicity itself. And you'd better reduce all of it if you get hold of it. It's nothing to tamper with and then leave in the stimulation. Reduce all of it. You'll find the effort to receive and the effort to damp out and finally the motionlessness following it and so forth. You ought to get this on the individual. So that's your first engram. Major engram. Now there may be another between there and this next step. And there may be another before this one I mentioned, but the next one of which I know at this time is the problem of staying afloat. Now here you have an advanced form, a form of buoyancy. Photon converter, it's a photon converter, but it is a very advanced one. I am not absolutely certain what its nucleus is, but the individual gets the sensation of being in the middle of it when he's in valence. The center of the nucleus is there, in the middle of the forehead, evidently. Now, this may vary in pre-clears, I don't know. The point is that something is staying afloat. It's out in the sea, it receives sunlight and chemicals. That's its food, and it receives these sunlight and chemicals over many days, and finally expires and goes through another cycle. But at night, it's very dark. There are certain things which the photon converter, the algae, the plankton, whatever it is that you happen to be hitting, there are certain things which it mustn't do. And it has already learned at this stage that it mustn't go ashore. It mustn't get itself wound up in waves. It can already record to some slight degree sound as vibration influencing it. But it can't propel itself or move in any particular direction. But by death facsimiles, it learns to stay away from the beach. But how does it stay away from the beach? I guess merely by recreating its next facsimile further sea. The only mobility that it could possibly have. But it has already learned, it thinks, that it can handle time. And it's ambitious on this subject. But in order to float, it has to expand. Expands all over. Blows itself up. It gets a tension line out to float to the surface. But if there's wind blowing and it's night, you don't want much showing above the surface of the water, do you? And so it contracts. It contracts to sink. It expands to float. And sooner or later, it gets to the point where it gets a death facsimile, whereby it is trying desperately to float by expanding and goes on sinking. And here you get the first illusions of time track action. Anybody's worked very long in a time track has gotten mixed up with this illusion. Now, the illusion, for instance, of the birth embryo, very interesting. A person is liable to key in these early converter embryos because he's trying to expand so he can get up to a point where he can breathe and function. Hence, you get that the normal reaction in a birth of the baby trying not to be crushed, and this will get multiplied by this effort to stay afloat. It's a very severe effort, that effort to stay afloat. The next major engram of which I know, and there are probably several intermediates there that have been skipped, but the next major one is not to get pulled up. Somewhere along the line, you've got a vegetable development which grows from the bottom up. And the only really horrible thing that can happen in this stage is to get pulled up and go adrift. Because they go adrift, they go ashore. They go ashore, they get in the sun. Sun dries them up, and that's pretty painful. So you get this effort to stay down. This effort not to be pulled up. Pretty sticky. There you're getting into some interesting data because that's a static state of being. It mustn't go ashore. And there you get your first sunlight engram. Dry up sunlight. You've had lots of your precursors with photophobia. They didn't like light, that sort of thing. Well, that's the first of them along that line. They get over on the beach, and it's pretty bad. Later on, there are many interesting complications occur, such as the bursting of small mollusks and that sort of thing. Strange somatics they are, too. If you know what they are and where to look for them, though, you can see a preclear hurting someplace. And don't bother with anything else. Just hit one of these somatic M-type engrams that you know cause that somatic and you set. Or you blow out whatever pain he has to be suffering from. It's very handy. No. All right. He gets out to see various types, forms, so on. He finally finds out that you just can't stay tied down to the bottom and enough death facsimile get together on this subject, and eventually get something like jellyfish. You get living organisms. Then you get, as we've talked about before, the first mollusk. Now, up to this point, evidently, you are a one-colony being. But here you become a two-colony being. Two complete and distinct lines. And this could really fool you. It's not, is it? Two complete distinct lines. Start back here with photon converters and move forward, and then along about the mollusk state, merge so that you've got a double control. That's very important to you because it's not compatible, and there is a major difficulty on the time track. Is the contest, conflict of two beings both trying to run the same house on an equal footing. One loses. It depends which one loses, whether you've got a southpaw or a right-hander. But the one that's lost contains a lot of apathy along the line. That epicenter is pretty well fouled up. You'll find such things as its control lines going to its own side. Its control lines extending only to its own side, whereas the other epicenter, when you get a somatic on that, you can feel this epicenter here, and you get the somatics over here. But on this epicenter here, you get the same side. You feel the somatics for it on this side. Now, they eventually work out the problem of government. And this is a wonderful problem, a wonderful solution. It's just all set for something like Russia and the United States. They take the government of Russia, and they put it in the United States, and the government of the United States, and put it in Russia. After that, they have some peace. And that is why you've got your right and left opposites of control. You can find this point in your frequency. There's a lot of stuff there, a lot of data. These two epicenters, however, are the most sensitive nerve spots that you will run into in the human body. They're here and here. They're surrounded by the biggest nerve. But these two epicenters, this one goes this way, and this one controls over that way. Now, there's a lot of stuff on the track in most people, evidently, that has to be straightened out right at that point. The next major setup, of course, is more contest with sun, gas, and putrefaction. You take somebody that has a very gassy stomach, that sort of thing, well, that's a very simple one. The sun hits these things after they go ashore. They swell up and burst, and so forth. It's very interesting in running pre-clears on this subject. The nastiest taste come in their mouth. They just commented. You don't have to suggest it. Well, they, teeth and so forth, are formed by small spores going out to the edge of the shell. But they also may be other genetic lines, but I haven't any evidence that they are. But you find out in the rim of the shell, this little mollusk will form. All right, when the sun hits it, it bursts. And the only somatic that nobody'd ever think of looking for in a tooth is the somatic to hold one down, to hold it together against tremendous gas pressure building up because of putrefaction in the middle of the tooth. And boy, it goes creak, 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 bow! The guy goes around with a toothache, they say, you know, well, of course, everybody knows that if you have a toothache here, it aches here and here and here and here, and it just aches all over the place. What you got is the person has picked up one of those service facsimiles of a burst. They're quite painful. Now, there's evidently a procreation going on, somewhat on that order, too, whereby the animal puts out a little something on the edge of the shell, and it goes on and grows and becomes something else. Or it becomes, maybe that's just the next generation, whatever that is. I found an interesting one, a concern for the loss of teeth because it was the loss of progeny, all mixed up together, all swirled up like firecrackers. Anxiety on the subject. Well, anyway, we come up the line a bit further. We run into various other types of forms. You start going into, oh, there's an interesting engram along the level of things trying to get at a shellfish. It can't let go, and it can't close down, and it's really a static. If it opens up its shell, which has been partially entered, of course, it'll be tacked all the way. And it can't close the shell. And it's a static. It's a very bad static state, this whole beach head operation finds the organism in more or less inactive states. For instance, it has no mobility. It hasn't even the freedom of the sea or anything like that. There's the sun, waves, beaten to pieces. It's very interesting lineup. Well, you start from there into progressive animal forms, and some of the interesting things is, I don't know how somebody figured this out, but he was evidently right. The tarsus and the sloth are man's ancestors. You'll find them. Now, if your pre-clear is very puzzled as to what form he's in, if he'll just go to a depth, he'll flick out a valence and get an impression of his own form. It comes out up the line. It's been amazingly accurate. The men who worked this out, working with a bad theory, that is, say they have limited their theory beyond any necessity to limit it, did a brilliant, truly a brilliant piece of work in tying together what had occurred. They were limited in their viewpoint, but it was truly brilliant because how does anybody, they look back and they figure out somehow or other how to connect the species up with another species, something of the sort. And it was just a fine job of sew together here. What was not fine about it is in the field of the mind, they didn't think that these things were on file. They never bothered to look for them, and they are on file, and on file the whole way. Now we get later on. A lot of speculation can enter in here, tremendous amount of speculation. How does a person get talent? Now, what are these mysterious elements like talent? It has occurred to you that if somebody were taught for 150 generations how to beat a drum, he finally wind up a pretty good Gene Krupa. And I dare say you will find individuals on higher and higher strength levels of talent as they are progressively trained in earlier generations. This is just a possibility. There's also the possibility that we've got our finger mighty near the switch, which turns on the knowledge line, all knowledge, all the way back down the line. As a matter of fact, the finger is more than near the switch. I've been fooling with it. And it's very interesting, very interesting. Evidently, one conceives here and there that his talent on some subject is shot before he dies, rehabilitated with repeater technique. This blind repeater technique possibly may have some effect on the rehabilitation. Start some guy who was trying to ride out and just saying something like, this is just gunshot technique. I mean, I, there are easier ways to turn this on certainly than this. But it's an interesting little experiment. Have this guy who's not going to ride, have him just repeat, I will never ride again. Or I've failed, I will never ride again, something like that. You could gunshot, theoretically, back into some earlier life failure or conceived failure and pick up the earlier conclusion. And it may be that these earlier life conclusions are effective, and it also may be on the verge that we're just on the verge of turning open the whole battery of theta facsimiles for the review of the individual. Because, you see, we know the valence mechanism. We know that the valence mechanism, going out of valence, occludes the earlier life. We know that in this life. So therefore, some adequate combination of this, a rehabilitation of an individual's ARC for himself, puts him back into his own valence, at which time, of course, he would have recovered. You also may have noticed this, that an individual immediately after he's operated upon has a bad memory. The new epicenter gives him a bad memory. And he'll go around for quite a few days forgetting things that he ought to be remembering. He'll finally more or less get the new one hooked in to the motor switchboard and get going on it somehow. I don't think probably there's any great trick. If this knowledge is available there, there's probably no great trick in locating it, getting full recall. I also want to call your attention that little boys, little girls, are made to agree upon who they are. This is the other conclusion line. They're made to agree on who they are. You're Billy Jones. You're our little boy. You belong to us. Great stuff. Maybe first he doesn't agree on this. And you possibly may find some pretty clear issues. You'll find periods in their lives when they didn't know who the hell they were. In their very early life, very early childhood, go around wondering who they were. And you'll find there's hardly a child alive that isn't going around with a complete concept that his parents are not his parents. The most popular story you can tell a child is you were a waif, you were found, they are not your real parents. He agrees with you, just like that, bang! Everybody in the past has interpreted this as the natural antipathy of a child for his parents. Yeah. Funny that it happens in every kid. You can just stack the kids around you. My research on kids is pretty good because we get along fine. You can just stack the kids around you, sardine deep, with any kind of a story which has to do with they weren't your real parents. And boy, they really agree with you. And I can recall myself times of standing around thinking, who the hell am I? I know I'm not supposed to be here. I'm supposed to be doing something else. What am I doing here? This is this part of the world, and I'm not supposed to be here. Who am I? Then go off into a sort of an apathy because, of course, I was getting into a step. It'd be interesting for you to check yourselves and check others. Because the person is made to agree that he is who he is. And it may be that if you just start getting up those agreements, that all the times when he finally agreed to be who he's supposed to be, you might spring wide open all the way back down the track. Possibility. We see what a man can do to himself with his own self-determination. Okay, let's take a break.